Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Yemen's Houthi rebels and the internationally recognized government of President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi are accusing each other of violating a UN-sponsored humanitarian truce. Edward Uranian reports.
The Saudi-led coalition says it is not bound by the ceasefire that went into effect on Friday. Houthi media report coalition airstrikes hit a military hospital in the capital, Sana'a, a conference center near the city, and homes of Houthi leaders in Saada and Amran. A Houthi-appointed health official told journalists in Sana'a the humanitarian situation is catastrophic. He said international aid groups believe 15 million Yemenis are suffering from hunger and millions of children face the danger of contracting measles and diarrhea. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United States says it strongly condemns the recent al-Shabaab attack on two hotels in an African Union force position in the Somali capital of Mogadishu. At least 16 people were killed in the attacks on the Wahelie and the Siyad hotels on Friday. Mortar rounds were also fired Friday at Mogadishu's former football stadium, which now serves as a key AU base. No casualties were reported. Serbia's Novak Djokovic is the world's number one men's tennis player, winning his third Wimbledon title in the past 5 years Sunday in London. The 28-year-old defeated Switzerland's Roger Federer in the championship for the second straight year. It was Djokovic's ninth Grand Slam championship. You can read more details on voanews.com. This is VOA News. China says 109 ethnic Uyghurs who were deported from Thailand last week were heading to Turkey, Syria, and Iraq to join Islamic militants. Beijing defended the return of the group Saturday in response to international criticism by the United States, the United Nations, and independent human rights groups who expressed concern the Uyghurs could be subjected to serious abuses upon their return. The Chinese Foreign Ministry also said it lodged a formal protest with the U.S. State Department over its criticism of the deportations. A new day of negotiations on Iran's nuclear program continues in Vienna after a late night of talks. A senior U.S. State Department official warned that major issues remain to be resolved in those talks. The U.S. has never speculated about the timing of anything during these negotiations, according to the official Sunday, after reports that a deal may be close and could be announced Monday. Meanwhile, a senior Iranian official said negotiators are working hard, but he described reaching a deal Sunday as simply logistically impossible. Talks continue on economic help for Greece as finance ministers from the 19-member Euro Currency Union are talking again today on whether to grant Greece a new bailout after failing to reach a decision the night before. Lisa Bryant reports.
After reaching no decision on Saturday, Eurozone finance ministers arriving for more talks early Sunday offered a mixed forecast. Finance Minister Alexander Stubb of Finland, one of the biggest skeptics, put the state of the talks at between 3 and 4 on a scale of 10.
What we are saying is that the conditionality that has been presented by the Greeks is simply not enough at this stage. We need to have clear commitments, clear conditionality, and clear proof that those conditions will be implemented at the end of the day. That's pretty much where we stand.
On the table is a package of reforms proposed by Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras with backing from Greek lawmakers. Some reforms are even tougher than those presented by Greece's creditors and which Greek voters rejected in a referendum. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Hundreds of workers demonstrated in Myanmar Sunday demanding the government approve a higher minimum wage. Workers marched outside an industrial zone in the city of Yangon and called for a daily minimum wage of $3.54 per day. That's well above the $3.18 proposed last month by the National Minimum Wage Committee. Myanmar's current minimum wage is $2.65 a day. Pope Francis celebrated the last Mass of his three-nation South American tour on a very special altar. As we hear his comments here, it was made in honor of Paraguay's native Guarani and out of respect for Mother Earth. It's composed of 40,000 ears of corn, 200,000 coconuts adorned with squash. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
How we can work together to create the right kinds of policies, to create the right kinds of connections between and among sectors, and to share real-time experiences about what has worked and what hasn't worked.
Heads of state and government will meet this week at the UN Financing for Development Conference in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
The citizens of Swaziland get to be arrested for merely expressing their political views in a country that is a signatory to the United Nations Convention.
Pro-democracy groups in Swaziland demand the immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners. We'll have details.
Parents are feeling in our responsibility of ensuring that these children are protected from these diseases, because the government is providing the vaccines free of charge, and we have just the responsibility to take these children to the health facilities.
And a measles epidemic sweeps through Cameroon with a report of at least 300 children infected. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Heads of state and government plan to meet at the third International United Nations Financing for Development Conference in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa beginning this week. For more on the U.S. government's perspective about the conference, I reached Ambassador Baisa Williams, the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in Addis Ababa. She told me earlier that with the private and public partnership and assistance from the international community, developing countries could use their domestic resources to improve the lives of their people.
Our administration is very excited about this conference. We're looking at the Financing for Development Conference to be a real opportunity to talk about the development finance landscape and to talk about how it's changing. We think that there really is, around the world, a recognition of the need to mobilize different streams of finance, of capital, in order to really have sustainable development. And our view is that the different streams of capital need to include private investment, but also developing countries' use of their own domestic resources, and, of course, official development assistance.
What role will the U.S. be playing at this conference?
We're an important development partner, assistance partner, but we also think that we have a good experience to share. And hopefully our role will be one to share information, share good experience, learn best practices, but also to give examples of how additional capital can be mobilized. So we're hoping to be a voice for and a conduit for a collective commitment to mobilize diverse financial resources.
What will be your expectation at this conference? Because sometimes pledges are made, but, you know, the funds needed usually don't come through. So what will be different this time?
Mm-hmm. What we're doing here as an international community is coming to look at how we can work together to create the right kinds of policies, to create the right kinds of connections between and among sectors, and to share real-time experiences about what has worked and what hasn't worked. So our drive will really be to talk about how to build sustainable and inclusive societies. We'll be talking about good governance. We're going to be talking about what we can do as communities to support and encourage and help build economies that are and governments that are accountable and that are able to deliver on the promise of sustainable development to their citizens.
Talking about private-public partnership, how significant mm-hmm. will this be in helping to really achieve the aim or objective of this conference?
Public-private partnerships are becoming increasingly recognized as essential and as very, very beneficial, and they are ways to maximize the reach of one's domestic resources. So I think there will be a lot of talk about PPPs. The whole point is for everyone to take a very serious look at all of the possibility in having different streams of capital coming in and how to really leverage them so that when you target the neediest in your country, so that the right kinds of assistance can be targeted to the neediest communities, and that that assistance can then be complemented by your attraction of outside capital. Among the things that we're going to be talking about, I said, you know, we want to talk about good practices. There has been worldwide an increased recognition, for example, of the really critical role and the importance of data, a collection of the right kinds of data as a tool to inform evidence-based decision-making, so that we want to use data from research for as a tool for social impact, for transparency, and for accountability.
What message will the U.S. be taking to this conference that begins this week, looking at the fact that heads of state and government and senior government officials across the globe will be meeting in Addis Ababa at this conference?
Our activity in this conference and our contribution in this conference is just another, is one more example of our administration's commitment to helping stimulate economic growth in developing countries, particularly in Africa, and in increasing trade and increasing the partners that we're able to take advantage of and to include as we try to stimulate growth and prosperity in Africa. So we look at it as part of a continuum from the U.S. Africa Leaders Summit and the U.S. Africa Business Forum that the president held last year to the various economic initiatives, Power Africa Initiative, our AGOA trade instrument that we use to encourage trade, which was renewed, as you know, recently by our Congress, and to the efforts that we're putting in to help African economies diversify, to support good governance, to the president's leadership and his leading of our U.S. delegation, for example, to the Global Entrepreneurship Summit. This is one part of our generalized U.S. government effort to say that development and economic growth and prosperity have to be linked through the participation of the profitable, active elements of a whole society. So we're hoping that message will come through as through here when we talk about the various streams, the three streams of financial flows that need to be used as a whole package when we talk about development.
Ambassador Baisa Williams is U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Swaziland United Democratic Front, or SUDF, has demanded the unconditional release of all political prisoners, including Mario Masuku, leader of the banned opposition People's United Democratic Movement of PUDEMO. Wandile Dludlu is the national coordinator for the SUDF. He told me his group plans to organize a series of activities on Tuesday to put pressure on King Nswati III and his administration to open the political space for democratic reforms.
We are demanding the unconditional release of President Mario as part of our campaign for the release of all political prisoners. And this coming Tuesday.
Why the sudden demand for his release, since he's been arrested for quite some time now?
We have been making as much noise inside Swaziland to raise awareness that it can't be that in this day and age, citizens of Swaziland get to be arrested for merely expressing their political views in a country that is a signatory to the United Nations Convention, as well as many other regional and intercontinental treaties committing to respect human rights, which includes, among other, political rights, and then come back into our country and do the opposite. It is now becoming unbearable for His Majesty to continue keeping these political prisoners.
Mr. Masuku was arrested based on his utterances, which the state found that it could possibly destabilize the country and plunge the country into crisis. They say there is a legitimate reason why he's being held for all these issues that could create chaos in the kingdom.
There is no evidence whatsoever which supports the government's position as a justification for arresting President Mario. He is a well-known human rights advocate. He is a well-known political activist. He has never in his life as an activist been convicted of any violent means of pursuing his agenda. He's a very peaceful agent for change. So it is on that background that as progressives, including us, we stand fully behind his cause together with the rest of the political prisoners, which is becoming clearer that His Majesty is victimizing for disagreeing with his political beliefs.
But your own constitution basically prevents people from joining political parties or forming political groups in the country. His decision to lead the band Podemo itself is an infringement of the constitution that governs the country at the moment.
That definitely is some of the evidence to prove His Majesty's hostility towards democracy. How do you sustain the pre-colonial conditions and hostilities, as well as a 1973 decree that still is alive in Swaziland? So President Mario, together with Peggy Makubu, Tulansi Maseko, and the rest of political activists in Swaziland, are pursuing a struggle for the democratization of Swaziland, which will present us with an environment wherein human rights, like freedom of expression, movement and association, will be duly respected and recognized.
So what will be your next line of action if by Tuesday the ultimatum that you've issued the government basically is not adhered to?
This coming Tuesday's activities is part of the preparation for the September Global Week of Action for Democracy, upon which we will be mobilizing, especially on the second week of September. We will be launching a series of activities that are meant to popularize the undemocratic nature of His Majesty's government, to educate the world, to raise their voice against His Majesty, particularly governments, the European Union, the Americans, to put their foot down against His Majesty's adamantly on maintaining an oppressive and repressive political situation in Swaziland, which is not helpful to anybody, and at worst, the Swazis themselves.
Aren't you afraid, possibly, of violent clashes of your supporters who come out in this call? Because it could be deemed as calling for violence and to destabilize the kingdom.
Surely. We have been on the streets many times. It's a well-established fact that we are a non-violent organization. And too often, violence is correctly located within the police force, who always come ready to bash people, arrest, detain people for nothing. We will not be deterred. We will continue to do all our best through, of course, peaceful means. We will not, because His Majesty is arresting us, is threatening us, and doing all sorts of uncultured or unprofessional conduct. We will not stop until we get what we believe is the best thing for all Swazis, a new and a democratic order.
Wandile Dludlu is the National Coordinator for the Swaziland United Democratic Front, or SUDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. The Kenyan mall that was attacked by suspected Al-Shabaab militants is set to reopen later this week. Westgate Shopping Mall in the capital, Nairobi, will reopen for business on July 18, almost 2 years since it was attacked. The mall was the site of the militant attack that left 67 people dead and hundreds injured in September 2013. David Ohito is an editor at the Standard newspaper in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. My colleague Douglas Impoga reached him to find out the reaction to the reopening of this mall.
I think people are taking it positively. They simply want to forget the bad past that is associated with the Westgate Mall and the terror attacks. And particularly for those who have been looking for jobs or who were employed there previously, it's a great time to return to work because shops and other businesses that operated there will be back. And there's a lot of hive of activities going on in terms of preparation, in terms of security. And I think the people are clear about the security concerns. They will continue shopping there, but the terror threat remains very alive still. It's a global problem. It's not only a Kenyan or a Westgate problem.
Some people say the risk of attacks has not reduced since that brazen attack on Westgate Mall almost two years ago. Are people conscious of the security now, you think?
Yeah, people are still very watchful, but we must also appreciate that security forces working in tandem with international partners, the U.S. government, the U.K. government, the French government, and many other partners have neutralized many of these terror attacks. That's why you never hear of attacks in Nairobi, Mombasa, Kisumu. The big cities are becoming more and more secure, but the exterior areas of Kenya which are marginalized and have less security forces are still very vulnerable to attacks, as we saw in Garissa, as we saw in Mandera over the weekend, and far-flung parts like Lamu and Soron. So there is still a mixed feeling about the fear and the reality of this threat. But I think security officers, together with international partners, are doing a good job so far. The number of those which have been neutralized, the intelligence is better. And key installations, I think, are pretty secure. It's almost impossible to carry out a similar attack within the cities because CCTVs and increased surveillance and increased police presence, both uniformed and those in plainclothes, are in good numbers.
There is this issue of balancing free and uninterrupted use of such a facilities like the mall, and a sense of heightened security. Is there a sense that the people are ready to strike a balance between the two?
Oh, yes. People are very okay, very cooperative. They are screened, and there's no problem in allowing the security officers to look at your bag or briefcase and to be searched because it's for the good of everybody. But I think bigger and bigger institutions which are mass-oriented are also installing screening facilities at the entrances to guard against any possible illegal weapons that could be sneaked into buildings.
David Ohito is an editor at the Standard newspaper in Kenya. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Nairobi. A measles epidemic is sweeping through northwestern Cameroon with reports of more than 300 children infected and several deaths in just a week. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the capital, Yaoundé.
Dr. Sama Julius of the Expanded Immunization Program in northwestern Cameroon says the measles epidemic got its start because people are refusing to vaccinate their children.
The cases that died was because the measles was compounded by malnutrition. Parents are failing in our responsibility of ensuring that these children are protected from these diseases because the government is providing the vaccines free of charge and we have just the responsibility to take these children to the health facility for the vaccines and we neglect it.
He says malnutrition contributed to the death from measles. Dr. Julius says the government is providing vaccinations free of charge, yet parents neglect their obligation to take their children to vaccination centers. Cameroon's Minister of Public Health reports that only 20% of the population seeks medical attention in conventional health centers. Consequently, many more children may have been caught up in the epidemic. Dr. Nona Desiree, Deputy Permanent Secretary at the Expanded Immunization Program, says they have deployed vaccination teams to all the affected areas to make sure all children are vaccinated. He says the vaccination teams will visit markets, churches, and other public places to vaccinate children.
Il faudrait que tous les enfants cibles soient vaccinés parce que le vaccin, il est sûr, il est efficace.
He says parents should know that the measles vaccines have been recommended by the World Health Organization because they are efficient and of good quality. He says all parents should immediately take their children to vaccination centers to boost their immunity to a disease that can have life-threatening consequences. The last time Cameroon reported a measles outbreak was from February 2010 to July 2011, when 37 of the country's 179 health districts were affected. Measles is caused by a virus that is spread through the air by breathing, coughing, or sneezing. The measles virus is highly contagious and can remain in the air, ready to infect for up to 2 hours. In June, Cameroon announced it had begun a mass vaccination program to combat a measles epidemic after an outbreak was declared in 7 health districts in the capital, Yaoundé. It has now extended to the northwestern part of the Central African nation. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The United Nations says its Millennium Development Goals have lifted 1 billion people out of poverty in the past 15 years. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga has more from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, from where the 2015 Millennium Development Goals report was released.
Established 15 years ago, the Millennium Development Goals were aimed at lifting hundreds of millions of people out of abject poverty. According to experts at UN Habitat, the International Human Settlement Program, the MDG has turned out to be the most successful anti-poverty movement in history. More than 1 billion people have been brought out of extreme need. But the 2015 Millennium Development Goals report says sub-Saharan Africa is lagging behind other regions, with most of its inhabitants still dealing with severe inequality. UN Habitat Research and Capacity Building Director Eduardo Moreno tells VOA the East Africa region in particular needs to implement various measures to achieve the desired goals.
Number one is to have a long-term vision with specific policies. Eastern Africa needs to urbanize. It implies you establish better connection between urban and rural areas. Third, you need strong institutions working at different levels.
2 decades ago, nearly half the developing world lived in extreme poverty. According to the United Nations, the number of those living in such dire conditions has fallen from 1.9 billion in 1990 to 836 million this year. Gender parity has been achieved in many areas, especially in schooling, where the ratio of boys to girls is now even. The report notes that new HIV/AIDS infections fell by 40% worldwide from 3.5 million to 2.1 million. And conditions in sub-Saharan Africa have improved in some ways. Although the region still has the world's highest child mortality rate, the rate has dropped sharply in terms of real numbers. In 1990, the under-5 mortality rate was 179 deaths per 1,000 live births. Today, the number has dropped to 86. But the report says the region urgently needs to accelerate progress. According to UN urban economist Marco Camilla, African nations must do better at collecting taxes and revenue.
There's a direct relationship between the capacity to, to collect revenues and to have funding available and the quality of the services that ultimately will improve environment for NDGs and SDGs.
SDGs are the United Nations' new Sustainable Development Goals. Those will be adopted later this year, replacing the Millennium Development Goals, which are set to be retired in September. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing bribery, an issue of concern all over the world. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, July 12th. It's match day two this weekend in the group stage of the 2015 African Champions League. On Friday, Algerian team USM Alger kept a clean slate by winning its second match in a row, beating Almeria of Sudan by a lone goal in a Group B match in Algiers. Striker Youssef Belali scored the goal on 53 minutes to hand the Algerian club the maximum 6 points from two games. The victory did not come without controversy after a seemingly late equalizer by the Sudanese club was ruled out because the ball from a corner kick taken by Francis Kofi was adjudged to have crossed the line before Sharaf Eldin Ali headed it home. It was a disappointing outing for Almerek, which failed to consolidate his victory in the first match of the mini-league stage. In the group saw that day two match on Saturday, defending champion ES Setif of Algeria was back on track after pipping fellow Algerian club MC Yulma 1-0. The victory came via an own goal by MC Yulma goalkeeper Tariq Massas in the 9 minutes of the game. ES Setif is back in contention after a 2-1 loss to rival USM Alger in the opening clash 2 weeks ago. Saturday's result served the perfect tone for the title defense mission of the Black Eagles, who are aiming to join a rare group of clubs to have won back-to-back titles as far as the Premier Continental Club Championship is concerned. Setif now has 3 points, three behind Group B leader USM Alger. It was the second successive loss for Yulma, which is making its debut at the mini-league stage of a major continental club championship. Turning to Africa's second-tier club football championship, the CAF Confederation Cup. Day two matches are also being played at the group phase of the competition this weekend. In Group A, a 10-man Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia beat rival Esperance 1-0 in a heated clash on Saturday in Rades. Defender Ahmad Jamal headed in the only goal 5 minutes after the break. Etoile played the remaining part of the match with one man less, after Brazilian forward Diego Acosta was sent off for a retaliatory action on Esperance midfielder Hussein Ragued. Despite the numerical disadvantage, Etoile held its own by thwarting several attacks by the hosts. Esperance remains without a point after two matches at the group phase. In Group B, Egyptian giant Zamalek went on top after silencing Orlando Pirates of South Africa 2-1 on Saturday at the Mbombela Stadium in Nelspruit. Substitute Mustafa Fati was the hero, scoring the winner 7 minutes from time as the Cairo-based side came from behind. The Pirates shot into the lead in the 68th minute before Zamalek equalized 4 minutes later. Zamalek, five-time African champion, has now amassed the maximum 6 points from two matches after also beating CS Faxen of Tunisia 2 weeks ago. In the group's other match played on Friday, AC Leopards of the Republic of Congo played 1-1 with host CS Faxien of Tunisia. Let's now head to Portugal, where the 2015 edition of the FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup is currently taking place. Two teams, Senegal and Madagascar, are flying the African flag at the two-yearly tournament. On Saturday, Senegal pulled off the biggest upset at the tournament so far by beating host Portugal 6-5 in their second Group A match. The result has given the West Africans real hope of advancing to the quarterfinals. Senegal lost 4-3 to Argentina in their opening group game. After the first two matches, all the four teams in Group A now have 3 points. For its part, Madagascar will have to get a good result against defending champion Russia in their second group game today, Sunday, to have any chance of advancing from Group D. Madagascar lost its first match, 4-3, to Tahiti. In other news, Serena Williams of the United States won her 21st Grand Slam title after a 6-4-6-4 victory over Garbiñe Muguruza of Spain at Wimbledon, England, on Saturday. It was her sixth Wimbledon title. Williams is now just one victory away to equaling Steffi Graf's record of 22 Grand Slam titles. She will seek to equal that record at next month's U.S. Open. Finally, the United States has returned to the top of the FIFA women's rankings after winning the World Cup. The U.S. toppled Germany after beating Japan 5-2 in last Sunday's final in Vancouver to collect the top prize in women's soccer for the first time in 16 years. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Just like the sun lights up the earth, it lights up my life. The only one I ever see with a smile so bright. And just yesterday, you came around my way. You changed my whole scene way. With your astonishing beauty, oh, you couldn't make a brother sing. No ordinary thing, a supernatural being. And no, you are brighter than the moon, brighter than the star. I love you just the way you are. And you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been, yeah. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. Hey, hey, yeah. Ooh, you are my African queen. Oh, la, ooh, la. Out of a million, you stand as one, the outstanding one. I look into your eyes, girl, what I see is paradise. Hey, you captivated my soul. Now every day I want you more. I cannot deny this feeling I'm feeling inside. Hey, no one can take your place, you cannot take your space. And it's a fact I cannot erase. And no, you are the one that makes me smile, make me float like a boat upon the night. Girl, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Yeah, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. And I know, oh yes I know, you are my African queen. And I know, see I know, see I know what I am feeling in my heart and in my soul. Oh, I know that it is love, and I know that this love was surely sent from up above. Cause you're the only one that I think of. You are my African queen, and I know that it means that you're the only one that I will serve. I'll give you my heart, my love, my body and my money. Every other thing you think of. In a man, who could think of anything better than you? Who could think of ever hurting you? Sacrifice my all, I'll give it all to you. You are my African queen, for real. You are my African queen, the girl of my dream, the girl of my dream. You may have never been. Oh, na la, yeah. Oh, la, you are my African queen. You are my African queen, the girl of my dream, my African. You remind me of a thing. Oh, that is the African. So I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you.
I love you, I love you. Oh yeah, my African queen. I love you, I love you. But when it
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
In a previous commentary, I had urged African economic policy makers to pay special attention to the negotiations between the government of Greece and its creditors in Europe. Now it has become apparent that the entire international community is paying special attention to the current negotiations. This is extremely important because the real issues at stake are very relevant to every single African government today. Set aside the side issues which dominate the media. There is no doubt that previous Greek governments have mismanaged their economy, that the Greeks have not been paying their debts, that the Greeks have also not been paying their dues. But that is not the real issue, that also the governments of Ireland, Hungary and others have gone through the same pain. The real issue is the question of austerity. The policy of austerity is a highly controversial one among economists. Conservative economists in favor of it. Liberal economists do not support it. Liberal economists believe that austerity programs are difficult to support growth because they are merely requesting government to cut spending and also cut taxes will not help. So they do not support it. But governments such as the United Kingdom and France and Germany support it. So here you have a government like Greece challenging this orthodoxy. That is the real issue. And that government has the courage to go to the people of Greece and put it to a vote. And you recall that when they called for the referendum, most of the creditors in Europe called for a yes vote, including the head of the IMF, Lagarde. But what was the result? It was a resounding no vote. My belief is, if you put the issue of austerity even to many European governments like Britain, Germany, the people will reject it. And this is why they are so stubborn, because they are afraid that if Greece succeeds, then it will have serious implications for the people of Spain, of Portugal, and Italy. And that's why it is such a difficult issue to resolve. But we are now at a stage when the government of Greece might find a way to compromise because it has now proved that it cannot be the tech sector, that it will only do what it wants to do and with the support of its people. And last week, it went to its parliament with a very difficult program, which has now been approved by the parliament. We'll have to see whether the creditors are going to support it. But for many African governments, it demonstrates that they have to have some backbone when dealing with international financial institutions like IMF and the World Bank, and not always give in and allow them to dictate what their economic and financial program should be. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the hunter in pursuit of an elephant does not stop to throw stones at birds. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department prepares detailed reports assessing respect for human rights around the world. The reports, required by law, evaluate how the governments of every country and a number of territories demonstrate respect for human dignity and individual freedoms. Lawmakers, as well as authorities in the executive branch, use the reports to help shape our nation's foreign policies. They also signal to the human rights defenders and activists under siege that our government recognizes their struggle and stands with them. There has been some improvement in the human rights picture in Vietnam, but many concerns remain. The most significant human rights problems there were severe government restrictions on citizens' political rights, particularly their right to change their government through free and fair elections, limits on citizens' civil liberties, including freedom of assembly and expression, and inadequate protection of citizens' due process rights, including protection against arbitrary detention. On January 1st, the President signed and promulgated significant amendments to the Constitution, including a dedicated chapter on human rights, and the government is debating the legal reforms to implement laws to reflect these constitutional changes. We understand that every country, including the United States, has room to improve on human rights. We are committed to the work of advancing universal rights, building the partnerships that will move us forward, helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. We will continue to work with the Vietnamese government and people to advocate for greater respect for human rights in Vietnam. In cases of nations such as Vietnam, we are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.